I've enjoyed playing here. This has been over 20 years that I've been coming to Royal Melbourne. This is the way golf should be played.
We love coming down under.
Look, it's phenomenal to play. The quality of the golf's been great. But the enthusiasm of the people has been the thing that's just been amazing.
Tier of courses that I'm willing to shave my neck for in Kingston Heath, Victoria. Get me out of bed to shave.
Especially somewhere like Australia in the Sand Belt, and I have so many great memories of being down there.
Welcome back to Australian Golf Passport. Scott Warren here, as always. Matt Mollica riding shotgun. G'day, Matty.
Hi, Scott. Feel like I've got to start this episode by offering a hearty congratulations from everyone who regularly listens to the pod for your stirring win over New South Wales Golf Club's testing course yesterday.
Thank you, mate.
Career high, lifetime achievement unlocked, trophy, name in gold, the stuff that we all dream of. And just so happy for you, and brought a tremendous smile to my face seeing you with the spoils of your victory yesterday.
Brought a tremendous smile to my face doing it. So, you know, what's funny is I didn't want to talk about it on the pod until it was done because, you know, I talked about how I wanted to make the top 16 for match play for the champs. And I actually was thinking about during my second round of qualifying that, you know, there were people who would be expecting to hear the outcome of that. And it didn't inspire me. It might have distracted me. So once I was into the A reserve field and it was into match play, I thought I'm saying nothing to nobody until this is over. But now obviously I'm saying everything to everybody because I've got a trophy and there's an honour board that's going to have my name on it. And there's no honour boards. I've belonged to 7 golf clubs in my life and not a single one has an honour board with my name on it. So,
Wow.
And this is the special. This is the special one. This is the place that I wanted the name in gold leaf. So yeah, mate, I'm beside myself.
Excellent. So we're going to do, you'd suggested we might put a little poll up on Insta about the possibility of more detail.
Well, a few people, it's funny, like, and it's people I know, so vested interest, but they've said, do we get a blow-by-blow rundown on the pod? So we'll see, you know, if the listeners are like, look, I'd really rather nothing less than that, you know, we'll keep it. We don't have a Patreon we can put it on, but potentially, look, I find this stuff interesting as a listener. I love listening to people go through an important round and talk about how they felt and what they thought. And I think often there's a tidbit or two that you're like, oh, that makes a bit of sense. That resonates. So we'll see. You know, I'll talk for 2 hours about anything at any time. So we'll see what we get out on that.
And on that topic of talking, we had an interesting discussion with Steve Kuipert over the weekend. So Steve came to us from the media center at the Grange during the middle round of the LIV Golf event over there. And we had the pleasure of speaking with Steve regarding Australian Golf Digest's latest top 100 ranking list.
It was nice of Steve to make some time, particularly because Steve's like the loveliest guy and gives me more time when I'm chipping the AGD rankings than I probably deserve. But I think he appreciates that it comes from a good place. He knows that, you know, we all love golf courses and we all want to debate them. And yeah, he's got a unique position having worked at both Australian Golf Digest and Golf Australia magazine. So he's got a bit of a different perspectives on the rankings. And Steve actually raises a few things in our chat that I thought were really interesting. And I thought added a bit of understanding to why AGD does it the way they do it, you know, how it was that Cape Wickham came to be on the top spot. So, yeah, I learned a bit chatting to Steve and I always enjoy that.
Yeah, we all love the topic and really, really very interesting to hear his thoughts on it and hear his processes, talking about that live look at the scoring inputs throughout the ranking period. So to fill in the listeners, I'd started discussing things with Steve. You had a pretty hectic Saturday and then came into that discussion midway through. So Steve started that discussion. First few minutes of the podcast, he talks about his time in publishing in Australian Golf and having graduated from journalism, working at Digest, going to Golf Australia magazine with Brendan James, and coming back to Digest. talked about prior ranking panels and.
Yeah, and I mean, publishing's a tough, as a former print journalist myself, publishing's a really tough game and it's only getting tougher. And so I can see, you know, while it's not the way that the magazine that we rank for does it, I can understand Digest using rankings as a kind of gentle revenue stream in terms of, you know, funds from the readers. Also knowing how much rankings drive readership, finding ways to have, you know, he talks about their public access list and their second 100 list and all of those things other than the top 100 in the country that requires them to have, you know, as many panelists as they do. And that's something that I'd really balked at in terms of the purity of their rankings and their data. But I think Steve lays out a pretty good case that the potential noise that having so many panelists and, you know, potentially some panelists that might have seen a bit less or have a bit less insight into some of the X's and O's of architecture, the noise from that data is offset by just having so much more data for them to draw from to produce those lists and state-by-state lists, et cetera, et cetera. So I think, yeah, look, different perspectives when you debate them and discuss them in good faith, it's always a good chat. And yeah, I'm really glad that Steve made that time for us. Really appreciative.
Yeah. You touch on an interesting point. With such a big panel, I was worried that they had a relatively small percentage of panelists who had a really broad exposure to an elite range of courses. So sure, there's 270 and we've got coverage across every state, north, south, east, west, but how many of those, I suppose, possess in wine tasting or judging, I suppose you'd refer to them as developed palates or people with enough sophistication to say, well, I can split hairs in these courses between 1 and 6. Mm. And I still, Steve, again, talks about the way that they do things at Australian Golf Digest, and so he's made me think about that in a slightly different way. But that is one of my perhaps concerns when you've got such a big panel. And in his defence, Steve does address it, and they publish the scores from the 13 panellists, so just the 5% of their panel that saw both Wickham and Royal Melbourne during this latest judging period. So they pay particular focus to that.
Yeah, so look, I think it would be an interesting listen for anyone who might have a strong view one way or the other. I know a lot of people were shocked and appalled, not just that RM West dropped off the top spot, but that it was Cape Wickham that unseated it. But I think Steve's got, you know, some really good insights into how they got to that point. And yeah, the way that he really prosecuted the data, you know, he I think appreciated what a big thing this was going to be if it happened. And you know, regardless of how the data was cut, it was 1-2 in the same order. So, yeah, going to be a good interview for the people to listen to, I hope.
Yeah, will be. Before we get to Steve, got to do a little bit of business.
Oh, sorry. Before we move off that, I have a question for you about your recent trip that touches on our discussion with Steve, because one of the things that we got a little bit into, and we'll probably end up getting into this as a proper topic for an episode, is whether Australian golf is a bit overrated in terms of the number of great courses we have. Not how great our great ones are. We know that they're world class, but just how much our list kind of drops off pretty steeply. Now, you recently got back from your trip to the Masters. You played a fair bit of golf in South Carolina. And I was thinking during the week, actually, even before we spoke to Steve, if Australia were to annex South Carolina, I don't know how we'd win that war because they're armed to the teeth over there, but just say we did. And they're a state of Australia. Where in Australia would you rank now? Old Barnwell and Tree Farm aren't ranked yet in the States, but Palmetto is ranked 99, I think, in the US. Where would you rank that if South Carolina were a state of Australia?
A friend asked me this last night, played 9 at sunset on Sunday afternoon, Sunday evening, and I pretty quickly realised that Palmetto would be top 25 in Australia.
Yeah.
And I think that Old Barnwell and Tree Farm are both better than Palmetto.
Yeah. I think 25 is probably conservative. You know, if you think like Lonsdale Links and Barwon Heads are sort of your 2019-20ish.
Well, I'd said to my mate that Palmetto's better than Barwon Heads, isn't it? And that was my frame of reference, thinking mm-hmm. it's going to be thereabouts. So
that, you know, that's the 99th best course in America, and it's, you know, it's probably landing in the high teens here straight away. So, you know, we're a much smaller golf market. We don't expect to have as many, but as an example, I think it does kind of illustrate that discussion a little bit. And like all the other topics that we touched on, Steve had some really good insights on that. So, but yes, pay some bills first.
Yeah, I'm just going to do a little bit for Burnley Brewing. I was very interested to see that they now offer a Belgian triple as the weather's turning a bit cooler. Guys at Burnley Brewing are looking to warmer brews, and this Belgian beer has a rounded malt flavour, firm bitterness and dry finish. Triple apparently is a classic Belgian strong ale popularised by Trappist monks. It's aromatic with fruity, spicy notes balanced by a mellow warmth. And for those of you like me who sometimes judge a drink by the label on the bottle or the appearance of the can, this is a very attractive can. I think you'll like it. 440ml can.
I would like.
It makes a lot of sense, as things have got pretty cold pretty quickly down here in Melbourne, to get into a beer like this. Don't make the mistake that I made with the pineapple poltergeist. Get into Burnley Brewing, Bridge Road, Richmond. Grab this before it disappears.
Sounds like a dive off the 10-meter platform.
or something that Torval and Dean might have done ice skating.
Yes, true. Our younger listeners might not know who Torval and Dean are, but
most of them won't know who. So yeah, thank you to Burnley Brewing. Thank you for supporting us, guys. You look forward to tasting some of that soon.
I met, moving on, Angus and Grace go golfing. I met Matt Burns' dad yesterday at the club championship presentation lunch after we all finished matches. And he was, of course, rocking the free button pocket polo. And mate, that shirt just looks good on absolutely everybody. I haven't seen a person in it yet that it hasn't flattered. And yeah, just add it to the list. It's a great shirt. We've covered before. It's at a great price. I've also, getting cold in Melbourne, you're looking to warm beers. It's getting cold in Sydney. And I pulled out my Angus and Grace quarter zip last week. And mate, it's even warmer and comfier than I remembered. That's going to be my uniform this winter, I think. So absolutely getting into colder temperatures. We're wearing some warmer clothes. We're drinking some warmer beers. But the three-button pocket polo is the staple. Matt's just restocked it in some new colours, new stock of some favourite colours. So be checking out angusandgracegogolfing.com. Have a look at Angus and Grace Go Golfing on Insta. And, of course, if you're in Sydney, if you've been watching No Laying Up's Tourist Source, you would have seen they visited Matt as their first port of call once they landed in Sydney. Got some great footage of his store. So if you saw that, you'll know you need to get in there into William Street, Paddington, and have a look around. If you haven't seen it, jump onto YouTube, No Laying Up Tourist Source, Episode 1. There's a bald bloke hanging out in the shop in a Golf Daddy T-shirt. I apologise for him. But, yeah, shows off Matt and his store really well. Speaking of showing off Matt, you, just before we hit record, you had a great comp for Matt Burns.
Yeah, I said if Michael Hutchence from In Excess fame played golf, that he would be Matt Burns.
I can absolutely see it.
Almost separated at birth, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Two very cool humans.
Yeah. All right. Let's get into our discussion with Steve on Australia's top 100 rankings from Australian Golf Digest. The big news of their rankings for 2024 is that we have a new number one, a public course, and Royal Melbourne has been dislodged from that perennial top spot.
Yeah, the art analogy, I think, works really well with golf courses, you know, and whether you mean like literal art, portraits, painting, or you're talking movies, or you know, anything where there's complete subjectivity or even a trace of it, I think is a ripe comparison when you talking about golf courses. I mean, yeah, we know what's good architecture in terms of some basic tenets that all architects know. But then there's such an opportunity for freedom of expression and interpretation of the land and everything else. You know, that's where the real sort of nitty-gritty comes down to when you're appraising and evaluating golf courses, isn't it?
Definitely. And I reckon with architects being more accessible and sharing more and being members of forums and tweeting and so on, you sort of get an insight into their craft. Two instances jump out with me in regard to how Tom Doak's practiced in the last 25 years. He very deliberately took golfers on that walk from from four green to five tee at Barnboogle, knowing that that would heighten that experience. And similarly, ended up looking at 17 at Tarriety with the hen and chicks in the background, thinking, oh, that was pretty fortuitous, because that's really, really picturesque and adds to this total experience. So I like to think he's probably the greatest living architect and one of the best 10 in the last century. And yet he's acutely aware of that aesthetic element and subjective element, despite the fact that when people discuss architecture, they want to focus at times on those objective or measurable elements of that craft or that skill set. So there's definitely a subjective component to it. You're right.
For sure. But you're right. As a fraternity, the architects have done a great job in evolving and improving job of, really exposing the craft. Like you said, through accessibility, they seem to be keen on educating golfers what good architecture is and, you know, why something else maybe doesn't work on a certain site and why it had to be this way. And then you've got sort of some of the unsexy stuff like drainage, you know, the kind of thing that your average golfer doesn't consider, but really is a foundation of a lot of their work. And just, yeah, educating and explaining to average golfers why this had to happen and why this hole is like this and not like that. And there's a real, Harley Cruz has said to me a couple of times in the last few years, there's a growing band of golfers, as he says, probably in that 30 to 50 year old bracket, whose interest in course architecture has really grown. And like we've seen with forums, and we've seen it discussed in you know, public places. And so it's a rising element of the golf course sort of side of the sport is interest, but also improving knowledge, partly because there are interest levels, but also because the architects are willing to kind of explain themselves in many ways.
Yeah. Yeah. And books. I've mentioned a couple of times on the podcast, Jeff Shackelford's most recent book about golf architecture for normal people, which is just a brilliant entry point into that field. And that brings a huge amount of knowledge to the masses and sort of shines a light on some stuff that you might not otherwise understand or might not think about. So,
exactly.
If we just backtrack a little bit, we should have probably started at the start of our run sheet.
Yes, well, that's true.
If you want to tell us a little bit about yourself, Steve, introduce yourself to our listenership and perhaps talk about your time in golf in Australia, your time in golf journalism in Australia, the places you've worked and the things you've seen.
Yeah, for sure. It's actually kind of interesting timing that you're asking me that at this point, because in about 2 weeks, I actually hit the point where I'll have worked in the golf media for 50% of my life. Obviously I've worked for Golf Digest in two separate stints, but my first one began 2 days after my 24th birthday, and in 2 weeks I turned 48. So I'm actually going to be at the point where, you know, working in the golf media will be 50% of my life. I was a kid who played cricket in summer and soccer in winter, sort of through primary school and early years of high school. My dad introduced me to golf when I was 10. I loved it straight away, but I kind of dovetailed it with the other sports for a couple of years. But by about age 13, it was all I wanted to do. There was no more cricket, no more soccer, and it was just all golf. I joined my first golf club, Wakehurst Golf Club on the north side of Sydney, at age 13, And yeah, that was my every weekend, really, straight away. From that point onwards, obviously went into journalism at university, and I didn't necessarily see myself going into the Gulf media. I sort of was a good year and a half into my degree before I suddenly realized where it could take me. I was interested in sport, certainly, not necessarily specifically golf, but that's sort of the way it wound up going. About halfway through my last year of uni, I made contact with Australian Golf Digest about doing some work experience with them. And so this is 1997. I remember it was actually the week of the Open at Troon that Justin Leonard won.
Okay.
And I spent the week with them there, enjoyed it. I think they enjoyed having me there. I just then made a point of keeping in sort of occasional but regular contact with them. I finished uni, went off working in country newspapers for a couple of years. And eventually, yeah, early in 2000, there was an opening and a vacancy, and they, asked me to come and have a chat with them, and it went from there. And yeah, 8th of May 2000, I started there. I worked under Rowan Clark, who still works for us. He was the editor, but then left to sort of pursue writing as opposed to editing. Because I think that's probably an area that, your average reader of a magazine perhaps underappreciates, that the editing side of the magazine really is a full-time role. You don't actually get a lot of time to write yourself, and that's what he wanted to do. So in 2004, he sort of stepped sideways, I suppose, to focus on writing. I took over as editor, stayed there till 2012, when Golf Australia magazine approached me to jump ship, which was not an easy decision to make, but given the respective kind of momentum, I think is probably the best word to use, the momentum of the two magazines at that time, it was actually, I still say to this day, it was actually a smart move at the time. But then there was a change of ownership a few years later of Golf Digest. To CWMA Digital and Print, which is the current owners. That was about 2015. And again, about a year later, there was a vacancy there. And my current boss, Nick Cutler, approached me to would I be interested in coming back? And he and I had worked together in the early 2000s, so knew each other well. And to me, it was sort of an opportunity to come home. A few people said that to me when I moved back. They said, "Oh, welcome home," because it sort of, I guess, was my spiritual home in the golf media. And so that was late 2016, and here we are 7.5 years later, and I'm still here.
And perhaps the big reason why we've got you on to speak with you about, well, at this time, to speak with you about Australian Golf Digest, your most eagerly anticipated episode or volume of the magazine has recently been released, and it's Australia's top 100 rankings for their golf courses. And these, fair to say, these rankings issues are really eagerly anticipated by punters, and they're probably the most heavily purchased copies of the magazines each year or every other year. People want to see what's number one, what courses made it, where their home course is, what courses missed out. And this year's results were a little controversial.
Yes. Let's just say from probably course three down to 100, there's maybe not a lot of controversy. There might be a few raised eyebrows, but it's the top two that have certainly stirred interest because for the first time, we don't have Royal Melbourne West. Sorry, not the first time, for the second time, but I'll get to the first time in a minute. For the second time, we don't have Royal Melbourne West at number one, and we do for the first time have Cape Wickham as the number one ranked course. The only other time Royal Melbourne in some capacity wasn't number one was 2010 when it was edged by Kingston Heath. But that was off the back of a period where Royal Melbourne had some issues with drought and water, which they very quickly fixed. But it was less of a surprise that year when Royal Melbourne wasn't number one. This time, I think it has caused a bit more of a stir.
Yeah, the initial responses online, from what I could see, it's a stir is a very good description. Everyone has their own opinions and ideas, as we said at the outset of our chat, and there's a subjective element to it. Australian Golf Digest has a really, really structured criteria for assessing and guidelines for people on the ranking panel to help them through that process of assessing courses and submitting their lists, don't they?
Yes, and it's it's been discussed before whether our method is the best, and being as objective as I can, I actually do understand the sort of opposing take that suggests simplicity is best. You know, no need for criteria, no need for even numbers or scores, just simply write a list of what you think are the best courses based on the parameters that you decide yourself. There's some merit to that. But we've adopted a more structured, as you say, approach of having seven different criteria, giving scores out of 10 in each, and creating a point system and evaluating golf courses through the lens of each of those criteria, assigning numbers to each and coming up with a score. And look, as we said, you know, there's art to golf course architecture. Is assigning numbers the best way to do it? Again, that's personal preference. I think of that brilliant scene from Dead Poets Society where Robin Williams' character is talking about poetry and reading from an erroneous textbook, trying to teach readers to score poetry on a scale of this and that, and Robin Williams' character scoffs at it and asks the kids to tear it out because that's not how you evaluate poetry. And yeah, look, you can certainly make that argument with golf courses as well. You know, don't just assess it on numbers, assess it on what you see, what you feel, what the reactions it creates in you. But yeah, we've just preferred to go a different path, having structured criteria, giving it some consistent historical consistency as much as anything, so that we can turn around to clubs now after nearly 40 years of ranking courses and say, right, you know, you sat here under this criteria this year, and 2 years later you're here, or, you know, maybe you were here 10 years ago, but now you're here and here are the reasons why. And look, there's an element of following what Golf Digest in America does. Obviously we're part of a network of quite a few affiliates scattered around the country that are attached to Golf Digest in the States. It is recommended to us that we follow their ranking process and criteria, but it's certainly not a requirement. It does help if their affiliates are on the same page when it comes to compiling the world ranking that US Golf Digest produces, but it's certainly still our standalone decision to stick by the criteria that they use, it has, I think, worked for us. It's just it's a different way of doing it. It is more structured, as you say. It is more numeric, but it's the way we've done it for a long time, and I guess I'd like to say it's stood the test of time.
It's been tweaked a little bit. That shot values category had sort of evolved and sort of changed now to shot options, from memory.
There's a few different definitions of the criteria. You're right, what we used to call shot values is now called shot options. Conditioning was a big one about 15 years ago, when there was a real focus put on, smart water use, and really the education of golfers that green isn't necessarily good, began in many ways with the rewording or restructuring of our conditioning criterion to firm and fast, rather than lush and green. And I think that was an important distinction to make.
Yeah, I think in this day and age, to anything a magazine can do to convey that message that brown is beautiful, that smart water use and environmentally sensitive practices are going to get embraced, and people need to get their heads around that, and it's going to be a net plus for the game at large and for clubs in particular, particularly in some parts of Australia. I reckon that's a really, really mature thing.
You're right, and I think it was a really important thing to do from an Australian standpoint. Again, it was something that the US mag reworded, reevaluated. But as soon as we saw it, we said, oh, this makes perfect sense. It perhaps even makes more sense here than it does there. I think it was a welcome change, particularly in the superintendent's fraternity, who were all juggling with various resources when it came to water. I think it's just been a positive move for the golf course scene all around.
Definitely. I can see on my other part of the screen that Scott's taken some time out of his day where he's been moving house and has joined us for the chat. So welcome, Scott. It's good to have you here.
Thank you, Matty. I was so appreciative that after all the crap I've talked about his rankings on Twitter that Steve would still join us for a chat. I thought I need to make at least a cameo.
So to give you some background, we've been chewing the fat for about 15 minutes talking about Steve's time in publishing, the historical evolution of Australian golf course rankings by Australian Golf Digest, and mentioned the fact that there's been an unseating of RM at number one, going to Cape Wickham, going to a public course. So you've come in at a good time to further sink the teeth into the discussion about where all of those courses have ended up in the 2024 rankings. And I'm really keen to see, Steve, you had mentioned in the text within the latest issue of Australian Golf Digest, which is the May 2024 edition, which is the top 100 edition for all of you punters out there wanting to have a look at this, go out and grab it before it disappears from the shelves. You'd mentioned that you had 13 raters within your panel who had seen both Royal Melbourne West and Cape Wickham.
Yes, that's right. I guess anytime you get a set of scores or numbers in anything, you do a bit of an audit. It's standard statistical procedure to look for outlier scores, anything that might be skewing the overall. And I took particular interest in the scores of both Royal Melbourne West and Cape Wickham because I wanted to be certain that we were getting the right result. Just as an aside here, this was the first ranking period where we were getting our panelists to lodge their scores progressively throughout the two-year period. So I was actually in a position where I could log in at any given time and see what you might call a live list. And it was funny how every time I did that, Cape Wickham was in front of Royal Melbourne. And I sort of thought to myself, oh, look, that won't last. That'll correct itself by the end. But then the next time I'd log in, it'd be the same thing. And the nearer we got to our February 29, 2024 cutoff, the more I realized, actually, I don't know that it is going to go that way. And so when the final scores did, in fact, fall that way, and by a very small margin, 0.22 out of 80, I then went in and I grabbed all the Royal Melbourne West scores all the Cape Wickham scores, and I omitted the high and the low for both, still the same result. I then omitted the high two and the low two scores for both, same result. I actually, about five different ways, looked at it in sort of auditing the scores, and each time was the same result. And then the last thing I did, which was the piece that you've referenced, which is actually a little breakout within the issue, was to take the panelists who scored both courses and look at just those scores. And it was 13, and that fell seven placed Cape Wickham higher, four placed Royal Melbourne West higher, and there were two who gave it the same, got the two courses the same scores. And to me, that was sort of the last check, I suppose, that, you know, that our numbers indeed stacked up. And it was then that we realized, okay, we do have an overthrow on our hands. We do have a new number one. But it, look, it's come as a surprise to a lot of people, but actually not to us, because two rankings ago, the 2020 list, the top four courses were actually very close. They just happened to fall in exactly the same order that they had been previously. But in theory, any one of those top four courses could have wound up at number one 2 years ago. And so it was the first time we sort of went, oh gosh, are we actually looking at a point here where Royal Melbourne might not be number one? It was close, but didn't happen that time. And then 2 years ago, it went the other way. Royal Melbourne actually was quite comfortably in front as a number one. But yeah, this time obviously wasn't the case. And I guess there are two further points I'd make. One is we made a change in the mid-2000s, I think maybe in time for the 2008 ranking, where we had historically to that point ranked just the composite course at Royal Melbourne, not East and West separately. And we went away from that because we really didn't treat too many other 36-hole courses the same way. We don't have a whole lot of them in Australia, but if you think of Indooroopilly in Brisbane, Grange, obviously here in Adelaide, they were all treated as separate entities, separate 18s, even if a club does happen to have a composite layout of sorts. And so we thought it was appropriate to finally do that for Royal Melbourne. But I think most people would agree that if we still had just the composite course, it's probably untouchable as number one. But going to East and West, I suppose, made it somewhat vulnerable in that regard. The other point I'd make is that the West course actually went up in score from 2022 to 2024. It actually polled a higher score than it did 2 years ago. But Kate Wickham just nipped it. And so, look, again, it's the numbers game. Do numbers tell you the full story? Perhaps not. But looking at it through the lens of our criteria, that's how it's played out this time. It's very much a snapshot in time. We could run the numbers in 6 months' time and get a completely different outcome. But you know, as of right now, on the doorstep of May in 2024, that's how our ranking sits, and that's how it'll look for the next 2 years.
Where does what does number one look like in Steve Kuypert's personal rankings of Australian golf?
Yeah, that's a good question. I even though I went to both courses at the beginning of the month, it didn't actually influence the outcome. The numbers we'd closed it off, the numbers would set. And I hadn't been to either course in 5 years. So I was able to really look at it through fresh eyes. I wrote in the issue, and you know, yes, it's been diplomatic, but it's actually how I felt. I said, if you offered me 10 rounds across both courses and taking out the vagaries of travel and accessibility, I'm pretty sure I would split them five apiece. They're brilliant for different reasons. Cape Wickham, yes, of course, the location, the scenery does wow you. But I'm still really impressed by the on-the-ground architecture there. And I think they did a brilliant job, Darius Oliver and Mike DeVries, of designing the holes away from the coast. And I think that's a real measure of any great coastal golf course. If you can't get all 18 holes on the edge of a coastline, which you pretty much can't anywhere, how good are the holes that don't have that backdrop? And I think Kate Wickham's inland holes are fantastic. But Royal Melbourne, you know, there's just something about that place. You know, whether it's for a tournament, whether you're even playing golf or not, it's just an amazing place to be. That golf course has largely stood the test of time. I know there's, you know, the length of the ball and goes these days, and equipment has probably not done it any favors in some senses, but in so many ways, it's stood the test of time brilliantly. Those green complexes and the greens themselves are just amazing. Gosh, it makes you think. It makes you think about every shot you're hitting into those greens. It doesn't matter whether it's your second shot on a par five or if you're a 25 handicapper hitting your fourth shot to a par four, that shot that's getting on board the green, you have to give the utmost thought and respect to. And we just don't have another golf course quite at that level. There's plenty right behind it, but we just don't have another golf course at that level really in the country. It's incredibly special. So personally, I mean, I've always loved New South Wales. I'm you know, originally from Sydney. I just think that is the most incredible piece of land, you know, in our biggest city. And yeah, I've always had a soft spot for it, and I'm really thrilled to see some renovation work going on there. Not that it desperately needed it, but I'll be really intrigued to see what the outcome is there. It's always been a favorite of mine. And yeah, would I call it my personal number one? Not necessarily, but it's a favorite place to play, I would say. It's the best way to put it.
And it's certainly, like, it obviously ranks, if we turn our eye to some of the differences between, say, the Golf Australia magazine ranking and the Australian Golf Digest magazine ranking, one of the things that I think that I notice or that I perceive is that courses that are extremely photogenic would appear to do better on the Digest ranking. I mean, New South, I think, jumps from 9 to 6. The Cut is higher significantly. Hamilton Island is significantly higher. Mm. You know, potentially that's part of what has overthrown RM, with obviously Cape Wickham having better views than suburban Blackrock. So, I mean, is that, as someone who's, I mean, you're in a unique position of having, you know, been heavily involved with both magazines at different periods of time.
Yeah.
You know, how would you categorize a Digest rater versus a, you know, Golf Australia rater?
It's a really good question, because I think I'm the only person in the golf media who's worked on staff for both magazines. I mean, there have been writers who have freelanced for both, but in terms of on staff, I think I am the only one. And you're right. There is I think it's a combination of the criterion and, yeah, maybe just the broader approach, I think probably has created two different schools of thought amongst the collective panel. You're right about the aesthetic side of thing. And before you jumped on, Matt and I were talking through the different criterion that we use. And there is actually one that is called aesthetics. You know, we actually put our hand up and say one of seven criteria and 10 out of 80 marks goes to what we call aesthetics. And I'll even read from it just so everyone listening can be aware of it. We call aesthetics, how well do the scenic values of the course, including landscaping, vegetation, water features, and backdrops, add to the pleasure of a round? And so it's a little more open to interpretation, for sure. It's, you know, some of the other criteria, and we really spell out, this is what you're looking at, this is what you're looking for. But aesthetics, there's a little more room for movement. But its very presence alone would suggest, exactly as you're saying, that you know, a Hamilton Island or the Cut, or certainly Cape Wickham, gets a leg up. And I would agree with that. Now, whether that's fair or whether that's right, again, I suppose, is open to interpretation. And it's certainly not deliberate on our part. It's just that's what our criteria says, and there is an opportunity, I suppose, is the best way to put it. There's an opportunity for golf courses with high scenic values to maybe get a slight advantage. And that's certainly where Cape Wickham won this particular ranking, was it was considerably further in front than the number two ranked course just in aesthetics. As in, if we break down just that category, it was about 0.4. from memory, ahead of the number two ranked course just in that category. So it was pretty conclusive just in that department.
Going down that going down that table of respective scores for course v course, that's aesthetics is the one field where there's the biggest difference between Cape Wickham and Royal Melbourne. So no course beats Wickham, as you said, whereas there's six courses that are given a score higher than Royal Melbourne in that aesthetics. So
right. And it's one of those things, it's eye of the beholder stuff. And going back to what you're saying about the kind of respective pools of ranking, and on the two magazines, the allegation, for want of a better term, that we've always heard, and I think, you know, we heard it when I was working with Golf Australia as well, is that Golf Australia seems to have a collection of like-minded thinkers is probably, I think, the term or a summation of the terms I heard was that, yeah, by all means, come on board, but you need to think the way we think. Whereas I would describe Golf Digest rankers as a collection of individual opinions. Now, is that an accurate summation of the two? Maybe in some ways, maybe not. And, you know, I've been gone from Golf Australia 8 years now, so things may well have changed, but that's not just my words. I've heard that externally as well. And so if you were looking for, yeah, a distinction between the two panels, maybe that's it. But yeah, it may not actually be completely accurate either.
Yeah, it's interesting. So that two things I take out of that. Firstly, back when you mentioned that you had your panel submit scores as they went, I recall when I joined the Golf Australia magazine panel back in, gosh, about 2011 or 12, the first list I did, we had, I think it was only three criteria, and it was like 60-20-20. And so I dutifully went through and scored everything individually, and then I sorted everything by the final scores, and I looked at the list and I thought, that's not how I see those courses. That I don't think that course is better than that course, but the numbers led me to there. So I immediately kind of tossed the criteria and just was like, all right, what do I think's best? And I'll go down from there. What I think is interesting is that, you know, given a kind of criteria-driven list like Australian Golf Digest has, that has more criteria, and it kind of asks you in isolation to evaluate every course without thinking of a different course. I think it's an interesting way to do it, and I don't think better, worse, whatever, but it is an interesting way to try to divine out someone's pure thought about a place versus their relative thought about it compared to its neighbor. So I think that's an interesting approach.
Yeah, it is. And, you know, I think you probably do want to see golf courses in isolation. While it's probably a handy exercise at the end to sort of go, okay, here's my list. Or do I actually like how these stack up? I think before you get to that point, yeah, it's healthy to see each course in isolation. I did say to you, you're right. Our panel do log their scores as they go, but they're not final. They can come back at the end of the two-year ranking period and edit. In fact, they can edit their scores at any time. So even though, yes, I was logging on and seeing a live list, it was always open to change. Because we actually encouraged our panel right at the end of the 2 year ranking period to go back in, just make absolutely certain that you have got the scores that you want for yourself. And so, yeah, there was always room for little tweaks to happen for each one if they so chose.
The composition of the panel, I think, is really interesting too in a few different ways. And the first thing is that Golf Australia magazine panel rank, you know, we have a smaller panel. Mm. My instinct is that it's probably quite Victorian-centric relative. I mean, the great golf in Australia is probably more focused on Victoria, so I don't know that that's necessarily, you know, a downside. Mm. I think what we do have is a lot of panelists, and I might be even just a little bit of an odd man out on that panel, because I think we have a lot of panelists who their concept of great golf they've been educated on the sand belt about that. And obviously there is, you know, a highly strategic school of design on the sand belt. And I can see, and we've argued this, you know, amongst groups of us who take trips and play together post round, you know, back in the accommodation with red wine open, about the merits of things. And I probably am of the view that there are some panelists, you know, I think we have a really well-traveled, good panel, and I think we produce a great list, but I think New South Wales is an example. I think where the heroic and the penal schools of design come to the fore,
I do think maybe some of my mates sell short the courses that are more of the heroic and penal school of design because they've been greenside bunker left, fairway bunker right, you know, et cetera. That said, so I think I probably would, I would concede that that's probably, yeah, that's at play in that list. What I would say to you, and yeah, did say to you on Twitter, and I've thought about whether I say this out loud because there's the potential to sound like a complete cock, but I'm going to say it. I just don't believe there are 277 people in Australia who are equipped to make the evaluations that lead to these lists being pulled together. And I say that having, you know, whenever AGD raiders come to New South, they often will throw them in my group because the pro shop know that I'm into that kind of stuff too. There isn't a single one I've played with that I've thought, you're a moron. But I look at 277 as a number and I think it feels too big.
Yeah. Look, it's a really valid point to raise. And there are a few reasons behind it. One of them actually began with COVID. The timing, you know, think of when COVID really hit, it was March 2020. We had literally just published the 2020 ranking. And sort of, it was like, phew, you know, wipe the sweat off your brow. Weren't we fortunate that the whole country didn't get shut down when we were trying to finalize this list? But then, of course, COVID essentially lasted 2 years. It was about that time frame. So it really overlapped with the 2022 ranking, which was compiled throughout 20 and 21 and the very beginning of 22. In fact, we made the move from the March to May issue in 22 just to create a little more time that summer at the end of 22 just for our panel who had been restricted in travel to get a few more courses under their belt with a couple of extra months up their sleeve. And we ended up making it a permanent move or at least a move for now. We've gone to the May issue again this time, partly because it means we can cut off our scores at the end of summer rather than sort of Christmas time. And so it creates that final window at the end of summer. I think Golf Australia does get the timing wrong because for a January issue, you would have to cut the scores off right before summer starts. And you kind of do miss that last window of opportunity to really get the most up-to-date look at the golf courses nationally. So we found when the 2022 scores were done, we really felt there was only just enough evaluations to make it legitimate. There were enough, but only just. And so it was at that point that we sort of thought, I think we really need to expand our panel. Did we have 277 in mind? No, it was just the way it worked out. We were also a little bit short on panelists in the smaller states, particularly South Australia and WA. That was a bit of a push because there was a distinct East Coast bias. But in saying that, that's just where they're based. Some of our most active panelists are the ones who live in WA, because they happen to travel to the East a lot. So where a panelist is from counts for a little bit. It doesn't tell the whole story. And so we felt like this was a much more complete set of data. And the other thing was, for the past couple of ranking periods, we've also produced off the back of the main top 100, a second 100 list, the ones ranked 101 to 200. And so in expanding the panel, we said to them, okay, this isn't just about the list of the top 100 that you can see on our website now. We actually want to grow the bank of data we have for a lot more golf courses, because while the top 100 should still be seen as the pedestal, 1,600 golf courses in the country, the 200th ranked golf course is actually still pretty good. And we wanted to, not just for the purposes of our list, but for the clubs themselves, we wanted to actually give them a window into, you know, where do you sit in the grand scheme of things? Because if I've heard it once, I've heard it 1,000 times. You go to a golf course that's not in the top 100 and they actually want to know, how far away are we? And so you produce a second 100 list and you actually give them some hope. You know, you give them a measure of, you know, look, here's where you are. And quite frankly, if you're sitting in that second 100, you're not as far away from 100th as you think, because the numbers get seriously tight. In fact, well, we often say that between sort of about what would be about 75th, 70th position and say 120 is actually very little. And so by extension, the gap between 100th and 200th is actually not as much as you might think. And certainly between, say, 100th and 150th. It's so, yeah. And so it was a combination of all that with that we felt the need to have a larger panel. It's a lot more admin for me. I would actually, from a sheer selfish personal perspective, a smaller panel is a lot less to look after. But having now done 2 years of a large panel, I'm a believer that the numbers bear out that, you know, this is a much more complete ranking process. And a lot of that is down to the fact there's a lot more evaluations, a lot more total votes across a lot more courses.
Yeah. I mean, I would say to your point about the flat structure of Australian golf and how close a lot of courses are together, it feels like to me, and Maddie and I have toyed with an episode of Is Australian Golf Overrated? Not questioning whether our great courses are as great as people say, but is there actually as much great golf in Australia, you know, talking genuinely world-class, maybe world top 200, as people think? And I reckon that I reckon the 200th best course in Australia is probably closer to the 65th best course than 65 is to one.
Yes.
Or even to 10.
Yeah.
You know, it drops off pretty quickly, I reckon, after, say, 20. And then it drops even steeper after, say, 45 or 50.
Yes.
And so I think there is a lot of merit in you're saying, you know, that if you're at 180, it's not inconceivable that with some judicious mowing line stuff, some trees, you know, maybe some greens work, you're into the top 100.
Yes, that's right. And, you know, it might not take as much as a golf course thinks to make that leap. And so, yeah, and you're right. And, you know, you might have just pulled 65 out of the air, but that's probably not a bad yardstick in terms of, yeah, where is the median point between 1 and 200? And it probably is closer to 65 than it's certainly not 100. It's probably about there. And so, yeah, it is, you know, again, a numbers thing. But yeah, it does bear out in the numbers that, a lot of courses outside the top 100 are not as far away as they might think.
Can I just say to that point as well, Scott mentioned people from clubs in that 100 to 200 bracket. What do I have to do? How do I get into the top 100? I would implore anyone in a club to not go spend money and make wholesale changes to a layout trying to get inside a top 100. Do those little things like mowing lines and tree maintenance and the housekeeping type issues that can allow a course to shine and be at its best for a considerable part of the year, irrespective of fairway condition, green condition, weather. That's gonna allow members at a club to enjoy their course more so and for a greater part of the year, and saves clubs needlessly spending cash trying to climb up the rankings.
Exactly. And tree management and vegetation management is probably front and center there. And fortunately, it is an area of course architecture and maintenance that's probably getting a little more airtime than it has. Because it's one of those things, you show up at your home club every week or twice a week, you don't notice those canopies sneaking out over time or the agronomy effect that has, you know, by creating excessive shade in certain places. And, you know, they're the things that it's helpful to have a knowledgeable set of eyes, such as a course architect, just coming in and being an outside voice. You know, a well-meaning president or captain or even superintendent can probably give their opinion, and they may well be on the money, but never hurts to have a fresh set of eyes looking at things like that. And you're spot on, you know, it is actually the little 1, 2, and 5% things that can have a far greater impact on improving a golf course than you might originally think.
I'm going to have to drop out at this point, but Steve, I just wanted to leave you in Maddie's capable hands, but thank you so much for making the time to come on. I've always enjoyed sparring on Twitter about these things. I love that you're always open to an idea and a discussion and a bit of a debate. I think a lot of people in golf, if they disagree, they disagree, you know, not the right way. I've always enjoyed disagreeing with you the right way, and I've really enjoyed hearing a bit more about the process and the list and why you do it the way you do it in this chat.
Yeah, no, my pleasure. It's something I both love and hate. But, you know, much more love than hate. You know, I'm always happy to defend the process if there are smart questions asked. And you know, yeah, on Twitter, you don't always get that. And so I'll engage with the smart questions. I'll probably just give a pass to the ones that are just belligerent and ignorant. But, yeah, it's like I said, you know, as somebody who's worked for both magazines and been associated with both rankings, it gives me, you know, a real sort of interest in to the two ways that it's done. And yeah, it is fascinating to see the different outcomes, different processes, but it's just good, healthy discussion. You know, I think if there's any uniformity across the two, it's we're acutely aware of just how lucky we are to have so many great golf courses here, and whatever order you put them in, whether it's you agree with one list or the other, or just have your own list, it's all just healthy discussion, isn't it?
Definitely.
And you both are receiving fair warning. I am absolutely promoting this episode on Instagram with the photo of you two fighting over the pineapple cruiser.
Oh no!
Oh, yeah.
Fair enough.
Scott is alluding to a pit stop that the Golf Australia ranking panel made at the Moon and Flat pub on the way from Newcastle to Elliston in 2016, where for some unknown reason, there was a pineapple cruiser on our table and Steve was just casually flicking it across in my direction. And I think I might have a justifiable wince on my face thinking, no, I'm not touching that. But
well, it's a younger version of both of us too, so we'll probably welcome that photo.
Well, still didn't have any hair at that point, but yeah, maybe a few less wrinkles. Now, if I do a bit of a TC here, I go down the leaderboard. We won't hold you up for much longer while you're there in Live Adelaide, Steve. But 2024 rankings for Australian Golf Digest have Wickham, a public course, at number one, deposing Royal Melbourne West. Number three is Kingston Heath, four Barnboogle Dunes, five the North Course at Peninsula Kingswood, six New South Wales, seven Lost Farm, eight Royal Melbourne East, nine Royal Adelaide, and rounding out the top 10 is Victoria. That is a pretty strong top 10.
It is. It's more and more competitive, isn't it? You know, you think we've got 7 Mile Beach coming and, you know, probably touted to be top 10. You had Peninsula Kingswood, you know, I think this is its third ranking post renovation, breaking into the top 10. It's a more competitive top 10 than ever. It's a more competitive top 20, top 50, top 100 than ever. I always like, you know, saying to our panel to use the 100th ranked course as a benchmark of sorts. You know, every 2 years, there's one course that obviously ranks 100th, and you ask yourself, well, is course A that I'm looking at better than that? And it does become more difficult all the time, because I think the 100th ranked course gets better every time as well.
Yeah, so that last five is Royal Fremantle, Maroochy River, Forster Tuncurry, last six rather, Murray Downs, Albany, Noosa Springs at number 100.
And there is something, with all due respect to those courses, there is something of an asterisk against each one, because there are nine courses that are actually deliberately omitted this time for a variety of reasons, primarily extensive work going on. So there's no Huntingdale, there's no Commonwealth, there's no Mount Lawley, there's no National Long Island, there's no Lynx Kennedy Bay, who are all deep into or just completed major renovation work. Commonwealth is probably the one that, just by the vagaries of time, could nearly have been put back in, but they literally reopened, I think, 10 days after we cut off our ranking. And so there just wasn't sufficient time for enough panel members to see it. But it's indicative of how much redesign work goes on these days as opposed to new builds. And that's the most number of courses that have been deliberately omitted from our ranking in its history, as far as I'm aware. And you've got a few accessibility issues. Once again, not enough of our panel saw Elliston. So for the second time, it's not on the list. And you've got Riverside Oaks main course or best course still coming back from floods, flood repair ongoing there. A good mate of mine's the superintendent there, so I've got a nice little inside look as to how things are tracking there. And I think they're looking at later this year before it'll reopen. And so, yeah, I mean, I think our final sort of six or eight courses are really, really worthy top 100 contenders, but it is also worth noting that in a normal circumstances, they actually wouldn't be there, which is saying quite a bit because you've got some really stout, really good golf courses in that bottom 10.
Yeah, so if that takes you down the list to 85 to 90, you've got places like the St. John course at the Heritage, Castle Hill, Twin Waters, Cypress Lakes, Federal, Secret Harbour, Riversdale. So they're at risk should that set of omitted courses come back into calculations for the 2026 edition. There, those courses are hanging on by a thread looking at numbers 95 to 100.
They are, but then again, we might face the same scenario next time. You know, we may have five or six courses sitting on the sidelines due purely to renovation and redesign work going on there. It may well be just something that we're dealing with each time, but you can only rank the courses that are available to rank. And I think it's become probably part and parcel of the process now that you're always going to have a few that are sitting it out. So yeah, look, it's, as I said, just a seriously competitive list. I'm always blown away by the caliber of the last few courses to make it in and by extension, the ones that just miss out. We actually had a couple of really, really good golf courses miss in like the first two or three spots just outside the 100 this time that, you know, probably entitled to feel a little bit hard done by, but, you know, there's every chance they'll be back next time.
Were there any trends that jumped out of that top 50, top 100 list to you while you were compiling them?
That's a good question. I mean, obviously with nine courses missing, we had quite a few make upward moves. And that probably just is common sense in a way. But I think there's a trend of rebounding. When you think of the two heritage courses, both coming back in, or the St. John course was in last time, but it made a 12th place jump this time. The Henley course now back in for the first time in a while. Clive Palmer's course at Coolum continues to bounce back. We probably promoted its return certainly quicker than Golf Australia did. It, you know, our panel were telling us quite early on, Coolum's back, you know, not all the way back, but it's coming back. And that trend continued this time, up to 80th spot now. But we're also talking about a course that once upon a time was ranked in the 30s. So that's quite something. But yeah, I think the courses where there's perhaps been ongoing work, I think of Cottesloe in Perth, where Graham Marsh and his team have been slowly upgrading that course over quite a few years, but a decent chunk of that work got completed in the last 2 years. And so up it went by a solid 15 spots this time, which is, it's a big jump. I mean, you do get more volatility in the second half of the list because of the tightness of the numbers, but 15 spots is still pretty sizable. So, yeah, I think if we were saying what trends emerged, it would be the recognition of work that's gone on in the last couple of years in renovation and redesign, but also courses bouncing back from, you know, perhaps checkered immediate pasts, such as Heritage and Palmer Coolum.
And any surprises jump out to you, particularly in reference to that pointy end of the rankings? If you said, well, the top 25 or even extending it to the top 50, were there, when you had your list completed, did you look at it and think, oh, gee, that's a bit of an eyebrow raiser, or I didn't expect that?
Not too much. Probably there might be two. Brookwater, which is a perennially volatile course on our ranking, dropped 7 spots on this occasion. But it's funny how often it has jumped or dropped by 5+ places. It's just one of those courses that does seem to bounce around. It dipped a little this time. And the Australian, which, you know, talk to anybody in golf architecture circles and you mention the Australian Golf Club and you get a spirited conversation. The Oz took a bit of a hit last time with us, fell from sort of low 20s down to about 30th, I think, in 22. This time it jumps back up to number 20. So that was a sixth place jump. Sorry, it must have been 26 last time. Sixth place jump up to 20, which six is quite a lot in the sort of top 25 to move that far. And it's still just a divisive golf course because we know it's a brilliant tournament venue. We know it's got impeccable conditioning in so many ways, but there continues to be a school of thought that says that the Australian is a little slice of Florida in Sydney. And, you know, maybe with its natural advantages that it has in terms of, you know, the sandy soil and just the in the ground features there, something more could be made of it. But there are some people who just absolutely love it. And we see it every time the Australian Open goes there. It's a great tournament venue. It just works. The players love it. But if you're really scrutinizing it from a golf course architecture point of view, it maybe doesn't get the most out of what it could have done. And so you do get quite a wide variety of scores for the Oz, perhaps unlike any other in the top 20 or so. But the rest of it, I actually felt like, again, every time I jumped in and looked at live lists throughout the 2-year ranking period, particularly the last 12 months, I kept saying to the guys I work with, yeah, you know what? The top 25 looks about right. It looks about where I thought it would be, or reflective of last time, taking into account any work that had been done in a course. To me, there weren't too many shocks in that sort of top 20 or 30.
You've definitely identified the two that made the biggest positional changes going down that list, Brookwater dipping and the Australian rising is, they're the clear standouts in terms of those red and green arrows in the list.
Perhaps the other one there is that's worth mentioning is St. Michael's, which came from well outside the top 50. In fact, came from 60th to 46th. They've put in some great work there. Sort of lives in the shadow of New South Wales a little bit, but people who are familiar with St. Michael's Golf Club in Sydney would know that it shares a lot of attributes that New South has without perhaps the grandeur. But they've renovated 14, I think, of the 18 greens as of the cutoff for our ranking, and converted the fairways to Cooch. And our panel certainly felt like that was a really positive move. I saw it myself for the first time in a long time about 3 months ago, and it was looking fantastic. And so when I saw it bearing out in the numbers provided by our panel, it made sense to me as well. And so, yeah, St. Michael's is probably another one that deserves mentioning because it had the largest move into the top 50 of any course.
I'm not sure if too many overseas visitors see St. Mick's or even go further up the coast, but they would be, yep, well, if there's anyone listening from overseas and wants to get a bit of a thumbnail sketch of the broader Australian golf landscape, that coastline extends almost all the way to town, really, doesn't it? You can play clifftop golf for 54 holes, not just at New South Wales.
Mm. Yeah, that's right. You've got the coast on the other side, on the northern side, and, you know, Randwick again above that. It's a really special part of Sydney, I think. You'd hate it to see anything but golf long term, because it's an incredible stretch of coastline. So Michael's, like I said, does live in the shadow of New South Wales a little bit, but it is absolutely worth playing for somebody who's in town, and in that part of town too. It's still seaside golf. You actually feel, I think it's the 13th green, you get the right wind and a little weather, you can actually feel the spray of the ocean on your face when you're on the 13th green at St. Michael's. It's quite something. You're right, it's that whole stretch of coastline in Sydney's east that gives us four golf courses that literally neighbor one another.
It's a great thing for a city to have. You've been really generous with your time. Thank you so much for coming on over the weekend while you're busy working at the Grange for Live Adelaide, while you've no doubt got other people wanting to bend your ear and discuss Australian Golf Digest's latest top 100 catalogue. I was going to close by alerting listeners to the fact that there is the possibility for some of them to apply for consideration to join your ranking panel.
Yes, that is true. There is a full page sort of call to action within the issue, page 108, I think it is, off the top of my head. And we don't know how many we will intake. My next job, now that this issue is out, is actually to go through and look at each of our panelists, and some are actually voluntarily opting off. And so there are going to be some vacancies, but we need to sort of have a look, despite what I've said about, you know, being a believer in the expansion of the panel and the data it created. We do need to work out exactly what is the optimum number of panel members. But we still are keen to go through the process of, you know, prospective newcomers at least having the opportunity to come on board. How many we'll take on remains to be decided, but we certainly want to create that opportunity for anybody who's got an interest in course architecture, plays a lot, particularly if you travel a bit. Yeah, we'd certainly like to hear from you if you're interested. So yep, that's certainly the case if you grab a copy of the May issue, which has only just gone on sale, so there's a full 4 or 5 weeks that it'll be available on newsstands.
I reckon they'll move and they'll sell out before that. There was only one left at my local newsagents today, so I grabbed the last copy. I know it had only just hit the shelves. Can definitely recommend the article that you've written in there, which starts page 110, where you had played Wickham and Royal Melbourne West on consecutive days. That's a great read for people who pick the magazine up. Just a great little thing to have in your golf library as well. I look back at the collection of books I've got, and I really cherish the ability to go back and look at those biannual issues of the magazines and think, oh, this is what the ranking was in 2006. This is what it was in 2014. So yeah, get out there and grab a copy of this. And those of you interested, as Steve said, it is page 108. Just cast your eye over the possibility of whether or not you'd want to apply for a potential for a spot on the ranking panel in the magazine. I can speak from personal experience. Steve does a tremendous job with everything he touches in print media, and he's been great to work with, travel with. So if you're successful in that quest to join that panel, I can guarantee you that it would be great fun. Thank you so much, Steve.
My pleasure, Matt. Always good to chat. And yeah, thanks to you and Scott for, yeah, not just, you know, looking at our ranking, but the rankings realm as a whole, because it is intriguing. It's endlessly fascinating. And, you know, we now move on. We look to 2026, and who knows what the landscape will look like then.